Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast, the week of November 29th. This week we were joined by Father Mark Massa, the Dean of the Boston College School of Theology and Ministry, and author of the recently published The American Catholic Revolution, How the 60s Changed the Church Forever. We spoke to Father Massa about his book when he recently visited New York City.
Well, I'm here with Father Mark Massa, and we're talking about his book, The American Catholic Revolution, How the 60s Changed the Church Forever. Maybe you can begin by just kind of defining the Catholic 60s. When did it begin, and when do you end it?
Right. As I try to explain, the 60s is a controversial designation. It doesn't mean the decade between 1960 and 1970, because my argument, and it's a pretty middle-of-the-road argument, actually, is that the 60s began at different times. The 60s culturally probably began around 64, 65. The 60s as a protest era began in 66, 67. My argument is that the Catholic 60s begin in 1964, when Vatican II's reforms on the liturgies kick in, and people came to their parishes on the first Sunday of Advent to discover all kinds of things that they were told could never change and would never change, like that the altar was turned around and the priest was facing the people, and Mass was in English, and there was all these new things. They were singing Protestant hymns. So I think it was, my sense is that the Catholic 60s began with that event, with the change in the liturgy, and went basically from 1964 to 1974. The 74, at least as a Catholic moment, as a Catholic understanding of the 60s, started something else. So I would say roughly that decade, but depending on what you're looking at and what you want to talk about, the years would change.
Now, you begin your story, as you suggest, with the Council's document on the liturgy. Maybe, I mean, obviously this is now such a part of the life of the Church, the changes that were made. Can it be overstated what this change meant and how it affected the average Catholic?
Well, I think it's actually hard to overstate how important it was, because I think Catholics between the Council of Trent, which is mid-16th century, and Vatican II, thought that their faith and their worship was something outside of time altogether. It was timeless, like the in saecula saeculorum that ended all their prayers forever and ever. And I think suddenly they realized that not only could the liturgy and the faith life of the Church change, but it did. And it was not done, that change was not undertaken by radicals, it was undertaken by thousands of bishops of the Roman Catholic Church who met in Rome at the Second Vatican Council and said, we've got to bring these things up to date. We have to reform. We have to strip away all the accretions of the centuries and go back to the worship of the earlier Church and recover some of the main themes of worship that had been buried over by all these centuries of things put on top of them. So I think the reform itself was undertaken, I think, with basically conservative instincts. In other words, they wanted to go back. The Latin phrase that they used in a lot of documents is ad fontes, which means back to the fountains of the original spring, you know, go back to the original source of everything. But while the impulse to do it was conservative, I think what happened unleashed a really dramatic sense that, oh, wow, everything, including the Church, including how the Church worships, changes. And I think that brought on a fairly dramatic series of events.
Well, we'll talk about some of them, but first maybe we could talk about the theme. One of the themes of the book is the notion of historical consciousness. Maybe you can explain what you mean by that, and specifically how it played out in relation to the reception of the document Humanae Vitae in 1968.
Well, historical consciousness is just a shorthand phrase that historians use to talk about the fact or the awareness that everything in history changes, that every single thing in history is part of a stream that rolls on. And that we are all in that stream, and that all human institutions, to the extent that they are human, are also in that stream, and that would include the Church. So that the way the Church, you could argue, and I would argue, that the essential beliefs of the Church remain the same. They are eternal. But the way we express those beliefs, and especially the way we express those beliefs in worship, changes and has changed. And in fact, we have historians of liturgy to show that that's the case. So historical consciousness in my book, I would say the main character of my book is not any of the individual characters I talk about. I talk about a number of Catholics in the 60s. But the main character is really historical consciousness itself, this awareness that arose as a result of the changes in Vatican II, that the Church itself changes, and the way it speaks about its beliefs, and the way it speaks in its prayer changes and evolves. And that's just a fact, and we have lots of evidences of those. I think that awareness, which today might seem a little obvious, and to use a shorthand phrase of my own students, it might seem like a PGO, like a penetrating glimpse of the obvious. It's not really a PGO. It's actually a quite profound understanding that what that means is that believers aren't protected from change. We're only promised meaning in the midst of change. And that's a pretty radical redefinition of how we understand our faith, I think.
Well, maybe we can talk briefly about the current affair and specifically the reception of Humanae Vitae, what that meant not just for state of sexual teaching the church, but, you know, about the standing of authority within the church.
Yeah, I think I'm not going to touch the question of whether Paul VI was right or wrong in this document. The church has pretty consistently said that artificial birth control is intrinsically wrong. But the way it was expressed in 1968, Paul VI convened a blue ribbon panel. Actually, his predecessor convened a blue ribbon panel. And when John XXIII died, Paul VI inherited this hand-picked panel of clergy, theologians, and lay people to study the question of artificial birth control. And the panel itself voted to change the church's teaching that, in fact, Catholics could. The argument they made was that Catholics could and should be able to take birth control under certain circumstances, under certain conditions, with certain moral questions answered. Well, Paul VI decided that to change that teaching suddenly in 1968 would represent something that would make the church look like it was changing its mind, that what many people had taken to be timeless teaching was wrong. So in 1968, he issued a document called Humanae Vitae, which is Latin for On Human Life, which basically reasserted the church's stance that said that Catholics could not in good conscience take artificial birth control. The problem, the big debate was not whether the Pope was right or wrong. I think people who understand that debate are saying, you know, it's either Charlie Curran or Paul VI. I think they misunderstand the argument. The argument is rather what Charles Curran, who's a priest and is still a priest in good standing of the Diocese of Rochester, New York, Charles Curran's argument was simply the arguments don't make sense. It's not, he didn't question whether the Pope had the right or the duty to say this. He simply said the Catholic tradition, which is not an evangelical sectarian tradition, but which is a broad church tradition, believes that human reason should be able to be used to explain why the church teaches certain things. So that while the basic argument is that we accept these things on fact, the Catholic tradition has always said, but we should be able to use our reason to come up with some theological justifications for this teaching. And Charlie Curran and the vast majority of moral theologians in the United States said, the arguments offered by the encyclical Humanae Vitae don't make sense. For instance, the Humanae Vitae said that the intentions of the couple are crucial in this, and yet Humanae Vitae allowed the rhythm method, which is a natural, quote-unquote, natural way, which regulated sexual relations according to ovulation cycles. And Charlie Curran said, well, isn't the intention of the couple the same in that as it is by taking a pill? What distinguishes rhythm from taking a pill? I mean, how is, you know, the use of thermometers more natural than the use of a pill? And I think many theologians, and according to Catholic sociologists like Andrew Greeley, the majority of American Catholics agreed with him. And I think that argument was the beginning of a long debate that we're still in. It's a debate that's come to be labeled as conservative and liberal. I mean, those who support the teaching of Paul VI are labeled conservatives, and those who question it are liberals. I think using those political labels actually hides more than it reveals. I don't think it's about that. I think it's about the fact that Catholics believe that the church did not offer clear enough reasons, theological reasons, as to why artificial birth control was intrinsically wrong.
Now, the name Charlie Curran, at least in Catholic circles, is fairly well known. The name Frederick McManus and his work with Worship, the journal, is maybe less known. Maybe you can kind of introduce him.
Yeah. The argument of the first chapter of the book is that the person who played the biggest single role in mediating the changes regarding worship was a Boston priest by the name of McManus, who was a canon lawyer. He taught canon law at the Catholic University of America. He ended up actually becoming sort of vice president of Catholic University. He was dean of the canon law school. It was a very distinguished academic career. He was also the editor of a journal. It was then called Errate Fratres. It's now called Worship. It may not be a household name for every Catholic, but anyone who does liturgy knows that Worship is the standard, it's the Cadillac of worship journals. It's the big one that everybody looks. He was the editor of Worship for many years, precisely when the changes of Vatican II liturgically were being implemented. And he had a column in Worship that, in fact, every issue explained what the changes were about, the historical reasons why they were necessary, and why it would help the worship experience of Catholic people to do this. I think McManus was the single most important person in mediating those changes. I think a lot of bishops, including, you know, cardinals like John Dearden of Detroit, worried that the changes in the liturgy was going to be much more dramatic, that implementing the changes on how Catholics worship was going to be a much more dramatic and traumatic thing than, say, changes on sexuality. And looking at it in hindsight, you could say, well, maybe John Dearden was correct. But the person who sort of made the changes in liturgy seem almost obvious and the right thing to do was McManus. So I think the unfortunate thing, you know, as a Catholic historian, I would say, is the unfortunate thing is that there was nobody to do for sexuality what McManus did for worship. And if that had happened, I think the Catholic community and debate of the Catholic community would be in a different place than we are today. Because anyone who goes back and reads those articles that McManus penned, those are masterpieces, and they're very, in one sense, they're very dull, they're canonical, they're church law things about why you should do this prayer and not that prayer. But pastors who were sort of frantically looking for reasons to explain to their parishioners about why we were doing this, pastors would read those articles and say, oh, this is a good argument, I'm going to give this as an example to my parishioners. And we know for a fact that hundreds of pastors around the country did just that. And so that after a year or two, what was supposed to be a big explosion, you know, the implementation of the changes, turning Mass into English, turning the altars around, there was no explosion. I mean, there was a very small, very loud protest movement, the Catholic traditionalist movement. But in terms of numbers, that's a very, very small group of people, you know, less than 1 or 2% of the whole Catholic population. So the big explosion didn't happen in liturgy. It actually happened in Humanae Vitae. And that surprised everything because, in a sense, it's counterintuitive. The worship changes the way that the reforms of Vatican II changed the way the church had worshipped for centuries. Humanae Vitae simply reaffirmed a teaching that had been there for centuries. So at the time, you would think, wow, the worship changes are going to cause the explosion. Nothing's going to happen with Humanae Vitae. And of course, just the opposite turned out to be the case.
Now, during the Catholic 60s and also in the 60s, of course, in mainstream secular culture, there was a lot of political unrest. And there was also kind of a redefinition of what it means to be Catholic in a kind of in a globalized world, and exemplified by the story of the Catonsville Nine. Maybe you can tell that story.
People who were alive at the time, I was actually in college at the time when this happened. The Berrigan brothers, Dan and Phil Berrigan, organized a raid on a selective service office in a suburb of Baltimore called Catonsville, Maryland. And I think it was an important moment. Not only it was an important moment in American Catholic history for several reasons. So it represents the first time that Catholic clergy weren't followers but were leading the other clergy and taking a stance on war and taking a stance specifically on the Vietnam War, which was then raging on. What they did is they went to the Selective Service office, took the files, took them outside and burnt them in a canister and waited for the police. They actually told the police they were going to do this, so the police eventually show up. And the police showed up too late because they'd end up burning hundreds of files from the Selective Service office. So the first reason why it was an important event is that Catholic clergy are now seen to be important players in the anti-war movement. Indeed, this was one of the most symbolic and important acts the clergy were involved in against the Vietnam War. But in a larger sense, I would say it's an important moment. The Catonsville Nine thing was an important episode in Catholic history because it offered a different understanding of what the clergy were about. I think Catholics had always been taught that to be a Catholic was to be the chief upholder of law and order, to be the biggest flag waver. The example I always give to my students is you drive through Queens, you see lawn after lawn after lawn with an American flag and the Blessed Virgin Mary statue on the front lawn. And what those two images are saying is to be a good Catholic is to be a good American and vice versa. And part of that meant Catholics were expected to be sort of the best soldiers provided for American wars. The Catholics were to be sort of the super patriots. And I think what the Berrigan's episode at the Catonsville, Maryland Selective Service Office meant is, well, no, that's not necessarily the way the Catholic leadership should be exercised in the United States. That perhaps there was a different model of how Catholics were supposed to be American citizens and good American citizens. And I think that was a critical moment in American Catholic history, because I think Catholics saw their own clergy, because a lot of these people were clergy, nuns or former nuns. Many of them were missionaries who had come back from South America and Central America. So these are all people who had spent some time in some form of religious life. American Catholics saw their leaders in a different kind of role, saying to be a good American and to be a good American Catholic doesn't mean to be quiescent on all these things, but really it sometimes involves taking a stand and getting involved in the messy business of protesting things that you think are wrong for the United States. That longer view makes the Catonsville event a rather important one. Unfortunately, I think it's an event that most Catholics don't know about.
The name Avery Dulles is one, Cardinal Avery Dulles, that a lot of readers of America would know, of course. You have a chapter on him in this book. Maybe you can just give us a sense. What do you consider his principal contribution to theology?
I think Avery, I asked him this actually just a few months before he died. Avery always considered himself a centrist. I said to him one time, we usually had breakfast in the morning. I said, well, Avery, when did you become a conservative? And he chuckled. He said, I never became a conservative. I haven't changed at all. And I laughed at the time, but then I decided to go back and look at his stuff. And I think he may be right, at least in part. I think what happened is that Avery never took much stock by those kind of labels. Avery himself never took much stock in being labeled one or the other. You know, Joe Komanchik once said that Avery Dulles was a conservative among liberals and a liberal among conservatives. And I think Joe Komanchik was basically right on that, that Avery took a centrist stance. And he had a good Scottish cussed sort of streak, so he wanted to sort of like present another part of the tradition to those who felt too secure in affirming one part of it. Why Avery was important in the Catholic 60s, the last chapter of the book is on Avery Dulles. It's called Avery Dulles and the Law of Unintended Consequences. What Avery did in his landmark book, Models of the Church, which was published in 1974, is he showed that there was a plurality of models of the church. That the church was certainly an institution, but the church was also a herald and a servant and a sacrament and a communion. And as I say in the last line of that chapter, what Avery Dulles proved was that pluralism wasn't an American thing, or pluralism wasn't just sort of a liberal thing. Pluralism was the most Catholic stance of all. That his book, Models of the Church, which is now considered a classic in American Catholic theology, showed that there were and there always had been many models of the church, and the church had emphasized one or the other of those models depending on the circumstance and the historical context in which it found itself. But those models had changed, and Avery said, that's a good thing. That's what makes the Catholic tradition Catholic. It's a broad tradition. It's a broad, deep tradition, and not a narrow one. So I think Avery comes off as one of the heroes of the 60s in my book, because I think he sort of legitimated in a very, very deep way pluralism as a Catholic stance in the United States.
And when you talk about law of unintended consequences, what do you mean by that?
Well, I think I'm using the insights of many historians. The one I chiefly refer to is John O'Malley, who's now a university professor at Georgetown University. The law of intended consequences simply means that it is important to know the intentions of the actors who start historical events. But once those events take off, historical events have lives of their own. And while it is important to understand the intentions of the people who started them, those intentions in no way can define the meaning of the events, because events, once they start in history, just develop. So there is now a claim, you know, by many people that, well, we have to go back and understand what the intentions of those, say, at Vatican II were in implementing reforms. I think that's an important argument. I do think we do have to understand the intentions of the actors who were there. But understanding those intentions doesn't eclipse a longer discussion about what the meaning of Vatican II is, nor does it necessarily completely interpret what those events mean, because once the reforms of Vatican II were implemented in the church worldwide, well, those reforms took on a life of their own, as all historical events do. And some of them are good and some of them are bad. Some of them went too far, some of them didn't go far enough. Yes, that's all true. But I mean, just understanding what so-and-so meant to do at the Second Vatican Council in no way closes down our discussion about why that council was important or what its impulses and reforms meant or mean for us.
Now, you end in your last chapter, one of your sentences is, change was not foreign to the Catholic tradition, it defined it. Maybe you could talk briefly about that to conclude.
Well, I'm a great fan of Cardinal Newman, who was just beatified by the Holy Father. Cardinal Newman, in an essay, on his essay on the development of Christian doctrine, said, "To live is to change, and to live long is to have changed often." Well, the Catholic tradition has lived very long. It is probably the oldest continuous intellectual tradition in Western culture. The Catholic theology and philosophy is the oldest intellectual tradition. It's lived long, and I think that discussion, that debate, has changed. I think the terms of the debate have changed. What we're aiming at has changed. How we want to use that discussion for our own faith lives and history changes. And I think American Catholics, like all Americans, don't have a good sense of history. Just to go back to my students, I think when I teach the freshmen, I try to explain to them, well, Jesus wasn't just like us, except lacking indoor plumbing. Jesus lived in a different world. And Jesus was as unlike us as he was like us. This comes as a shock to some of them. I think it's a fairly obvious statement. Well, I think what I want the book to help American Catholics to see is the fact that the church has changed. That's a good thing in itself, because it means the church is always trying to speak meaningfully and relevantly to the context in which it finds itself, and that context is always changing. So in witnessing to the eternal gospel, what doesn't change, how we speak about it, and the ways that we point to it, and the kind of witness we offer to it, of course has to change, because if we weren't doing that, it's like we thought of ourselves as some sort of time machine, and of course we're not.
Well, we want to thank Father Mark Massa for spending some time with us.
Good to spend time with you, Tim.
I want to thank you for joining us for this week's edition of the Merrick Magazine podcast. I encourage you to look online this week, where we have an archive of articles by Cardinal Avery Dulles that he wrote for America. Kevin Clark has also produced a video slideshow on the political situation in the Congo, where sexual violence is increasingly used as a weapon of war. Reminder that you can respond to our podcast by going to americamagazine.podbean.com. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.